Hope Leslie, or Early Times in the Massachusetts, by Catherine Maria Sedgwick. Here stood the chieftain, rejoicing in his glory. How deep the shade of sadness that rests upon his story. For the white man came with power, like brethren they met. But the Indian fires won out, and the Indian sun has set. And the chieftain has departed, gone is his hunting ground, and the twanging of his bowstring is a forgotten sound. Where dwelleth yesterday, and where is echo's cell? Where has the rainbow vanished? There does the Indian dwell. Volume 1. The following pages are dedicated as a testimony of respect and affection to the author's friends in Boston. Preface. The following volumes are not offered to the public as being in any degree an historical narrative, or a relation of real events. Real characters and real events are, however, alluded to, and this course, if not strictly necessary, was found very convenient in the execution of the author's design, which was to illustrate not the history but the character of the times. The antiquarian reader will perceive that some liberties have been taken with the received accounts of Sir Philip, or Sir Christopher, Gardiner, and a slight variation has been allowed in the chronology of the Pequot War. The first settlers of New England were not illiterate, but learned and industrious men. They seem to have understood the importance of their station. The Massachusetts colony, and some of the other establishments sparsely scattered on the coast, were illuminated spots, clear and bright lights, set on the borders of a dark and turbulent wilderness. Those who have not paid much attention to the history or character of these early settlements, if they choose to turn their attention to this interesting subject, will be surprised to find how clear, copious, and authentic are the accounts which our ancestors left behind them. The only merit claimed by the present writer is that of a patient investigation of all the materials that could be obtained. A full delineation of these times was not even attempted, but the main solicitude has been to exclude everything decidedly inconsistent with them. The Indians of North America are, perhaps, the only race of men of whom it may be said that though conquered, they were never enslaved. They could not submit and live. When made captives, they courted death and exulted in torture. These traits of their character will be viewed by an impartial observer in a light very different from that in which they were regarded by our ancestors. In our histories, it was perhaps natural that they should be represented as, quote, surly dogs, end quote, who preferred to die rather than live, from no other motives than a stupid or malignant obstinacy. Their own historians or poets, if they had such, would as naturally and with more justice have extolled their high-souled courage and patriotism. The writer is aware that it may be thought that the character of Magawisca has no prototype among the aborigines of this country. Without citing Pocahontas, or any other individual, as authority, it may be sufficient to remark that in such delineations we are confined not to the actual, but to the possible. The liberal philanthropist will not be offended by a representation which supposes that the elements of virtue and intellect are not withheld from any branch of the human family, and the enlightened and accurate observer of human nature will admit that the differences of character among the various races of the earth arises mainly from the difference of condition. These volumes are so far from being intended as a substitute for genuine history that the ambition of the writer would be fully gratified if, by this work, any of our young countrymen should be stimulated to investigate the early history of their native land. End of preface. Chapter 1. Virtue may be assailed, but never hurt, surprised by unjust force, but never enthralled. Yea, Even that which mischief meant most harm shall in the happy trial prove most glory. Comus. William Fletcher was the son of a respectable country gentleman of Suffolk in England, and the destined heir of his uncle Sir William Fletcher, an eminent lawyer who had employed his talents with such effective zeal and pliant principle that he had won his way to courtly favor and secured a courtly fortune. Sir William had only one child, a daughter, and possessing the common ambition of transmitting his name with his wealth, he selected his nephew as the future husband of his daughter Alice. "Take good heed," Sir William thus expressed himself in a letter to his brother, "take good heed that the boy be taught unquestioning and unqualified loyalty to his sovereign, the alpha and omega of political duty. These are the times when every true subject has his price. Diverse of the lenders of the commons are secret friends of the seditious, mischief-brewing Puritans, and Buckingham himself is suspected of favoring their cabals. But this sub rosa, I burn not my fingers with these matters. He who meddleth with another man's strife taketh a dog by the ear," said the wisest man that ever lived, and he, thank God, was a king. "Caution Will against all vain speculation and idle inquiries. There are those that are forever inquiring and inquiring, and never coming to truth. One inquiry should suffice for a loyal subject, what is established? And that being well ascertained, the line of duty is so plain that he who runs may read. I would that all our youths had inscribed on their hearts that golden rule of political religion, framed and well maintained by our good Queen Elizabeth. No man should be suffered to decline either on the left or on the right hand from the drawn line limited by authority and by the sovereign's laws and injunctions. Instead of such healthy maxims, our lads' heads are crammed with the philosophy and rhetoric and history of those liberty-loving Greeks and Romans. This is the pernicious lore that has poisoned our academical fountains. Liberty, what is it? Daughter of disloyalty and mother of all misrule, who, from the hour that she tempted our first parents to forfeit paradise, hath ever worked mischief to our race. But above all, brother, as you value the temporal salvation of your boy, restrain him from all confederacy, association, or even acquaintance with the Puritans. If my master took counsel of me, he would ship these mad canting fools to our New England colonies, where their tender consciences would be no more offended because, forsooth, a prelate saith his prayers in white vestments, and where they might enjoy with the savages that primitive equality, about which they make such a pother. God forfend that our good lad William should company with these misdoers. He must be narrowly watched, for, as I hear, there is a neighbor of yours, one Winthrop, a notable gentleman, as they say, but he doth grievously scandalize his birth and breeding, who hath embraced these scurvy principles, and doth magnify them with the authority of his birth and condition, and hath much weight with the country. There is in Suffolk too, as I am told, one Elliot, a young zealot, a fanatical incendiary, who doth find ample combustibles in the gossiping matrons, idle maidens, and lawless youth who flock about him. These are dangerous neighbors. Rouse yourself, brother. Give over your idle sporting with hawk and hound, and watch over this goodly scion of ours. Ours, I say, but I forewarn you, no daughter or guinea of mine shall ever go to one who is infected with this spreading plague." This letter was too explicit to be misunderstood, but so far from having the intended effect of awakening the caution of the expectant of fortune, it rather stimulated the pride of the independent country gentleman. He permitted his son to follow the bent of accident, or the natural course of a serious, reflecting, and enthusiastic temper. Winthrop, the future governor of Massachusetts, was the counselor of young Fletcher, and Elliot, the apostle of New England, his most intimate friend. These were men selected of heaven to achieve a great work. In the quaint language of the time, the Lord sifted three nations for precious seed to sow the wilderness. There were interested persons who were not slow in conveying to Sir William unfavorable reports of his nephew, and the young man received a summons from his uncle, who hoped, by removing him from the infected region, to rescue him from danger. Sir William's pride was gratified by the elegant appearance and graceful deportment of his nephew, whom he had expected to see with the slovenly and lawyer-like carriage that marked the scholars of the times. The pliant courtier was struck with the lofty independence of the youth, who, from the first, showed that neither frowns nor favor would induce him to bow the knee to the idols Sir William had served. There was something in this independence that awed the inferior mind of the uncle. To him it was an unknown mysterious power, which he knew not how to approach and almost despaired of subduing. However, he was experienced in life, and had observed enough of human infirmity to convince him that there was no human virtue that had not some weak, some assailable point. Time and circumstance were not long in developing the vulnerability of his nephew. Alice Fletcher had been the companion of his childhood. They now met without any of the reserve that often prevents an intimate intercourse between young persons, and proceeds from the consciousness of the susceptibility which it would seem to deny. The intercourse of the cousins was renewed with all the frankness and artlessness of the sunny season of childish love and confidence. Alice had been educated in retirement by her mother, whom she had recently attended through a long and fatal illness. She had been almost the exclusive object of her love, for there was little congeniality between the father and daughter. The ties of nature may command all dutiful observances, but they cannot control the affections. Alice was deeply afflicted by her bereavement. Her cousin's serious temper harmonized with her sorrow, and nature and opportunity soon indissolubly linked their hearts together. Sir William perceived their growing attachment and exulted in it, as he fancied it reduced his nephew to dependence on his will and whims. He had never himself experienced the full strength of any generous sentiment, but he had learned from observation that love was a controlling passion, and he now most anxiously watched and promoted the kindling of the flame, in the expectation that the fire would subdue the principles of civil and religious liberty with which he had but too well ascertained the mind of his nephew to be imbued. He silently favored the constant and exclusive intercourse of the young people. He secretly contrived various modes of increasing their mutual dependence, and, when he was certain their happiness was staked, he cast the die. He told his nephew that he perceived and rejoiced in the mutual affection that had so naturally sprung up between him and his daughter, and he confessed their union had been the favorite object of his life, and said that he heartily accorded his consent to it, prescribing one condition only, but that condition was unalterable. "You must abjure, William, in the presence of the witnesses," he said, "the fanatical notions of liberty and religion with which you have been infected. You must pledge yourself, by solemn oath, to unqualified obedience to the king and adherence to the established church. You shall have time enough for the effervescence of your young blood. God send this fermentation may work off all impurities. Nay, answer me not now. Take a day, a week, a month for consideration, for on your decision depends fortune and love, or the alternative, beggary and exile." If the pit had yawed beneath his feet and swallowed Alice from his view, William Fletcher could not have been more shocked. He was soul stricken, as one who listens to a sentence of death. To his eye the earth was shrouded in darkness. Not an object of hope or pursuit remained. He had believed his uncle was aware of what he must deem his political and religious delinquency, but he had never spoken to him on the subject. He had treated him with marked favor, and he had so evidently encouraged his attachment to his cousin that he had already plighted his love to her and received her vows without fearing that he had passed even the limit of strict prudence. There was no accommodating flexibility in his principles. His fidelity to what he deemed his duty could not have been subdued by the fires of martyrdom, and he did not hesitate to sacrifice what was dearer than life to it. He took the resolution at once to fly from the temptation that, present, he dared not trust himself to resist. "I shall not again see my Alice," he said. "I have not courage to meet her smiles. I have not strength to endure her tears. In aid of his resolution, there came most opportunely a messenger from his father, requiring his immediate presence. This afforded him a pretext for his sudden departure from London. He left a few brief lines for Alice that expressed, without explaining, the sadness of his heart. His father died a few hours before he arrived at the paternal mansion. He was thus released from his strongest natural tie. His mother had been long dead, and he had neither brother nor sister. He inherited decent patrimony, sufficient at least to secure the independence of a gentleman. He immediately repaired to Groton, to his friend Winthrop, not that he should dictate his duty to him, but as one leans on the arm of a friend when he finds his own strength scarcely sufficient to support him. Mr. Winthrop is well known to have been a man of the most tender domestic affections and sympathies, but he had then been long married and twice married, and probably a little dimness had come over his recollection of the enthusiasm of a first passion. When Fletcher spoke of Alice's unequaled loveliness and of his own unconquerable love, his friend listened as one listens to a tale he has heard 100 times, and seemed to regard the cruel circumstance in which the ardent lover was placed only in the light of a fit and fine opportunity of making a sacrifice to the great and good cause to which this future statesman had even then begun to devote himself as the sole object of his life. He treated his friend's sufferings as in their nature transient and curable, and concluded by saying, "The Lord hath prepared this fire, my friend, to temper your faith, and you will come out of it the better prepared for your spiritual warfare." Fletcher listened to him with stern resolution, like him who permits a surgeon to probe a wound which he is himself certain is incurable. Mr. Winthrop knew that a ship was appointed to sail from Southampton in a few days for New England. With that characteristic zeal which then made all the intentions of Providence so obvious to the eye of faith, and the interpretation of all the events of life so easy, Mr. Winthrop assured his friend that the designs of heaven in relation to him were plain. He said there was a great call for such services as he could render in the expedition just about to sail, and which was like to fail for the want of them, and that now, like a faithful servant to the cause he had confessed, he must not look behind, but press on to the things that were before. Fletcher obeyed the voice of heaven. This is no romantic fiction. Hundreds in that day resisted all that solicits earthly passions, and sacrificed all that gratifies them to the cause of God and of man, the cause of liberty and religion. This cause was not to their eyes invested with any romantic attractions. It was not assisted by the illusions of chivalry, nor magnified by the spiritual power and renown of crusades. Our fathers neither had nor expected their reward on earth. One severe duty remained to be performed. Fletcher must announce their fate to Alice. He honored her too much to believe she would have permitted the sacrifice of his integrity if he would have made it. He therefore had nothing to excuse, nothing but to tell the terrible truth, to try to reconcile her to her father, to express for the last time his love, and to pray that he might receive at Southampton one farewell line from her. Accompanying his letter to Alice was one to Sir William, announcing the decision to resign his favor and exile himself forever from England. He announced the affairs, and in a few days received notice that the vessel was ready to sail. He repaired to Southampton, and as he was quitting the inn to embark in the small boat that was to convey him to the vessel, already in the offing, a voice from the inner apartment pronounced his name, and at that next moment Alice was in his arms. She gently reproved him for having estimated her affection at so low a rate as to not have anticipated that she should follow him and share his destiny. It was more than could have been expected from man that Fletcher should have opposed such a resolution. He had but a moment for deliberation. Most of the passengers had already embarked. Some still lingered on the strand, protracting their last farewell to their country and their friends. In the language of one of the most honored of these pilgrims, Truly doleful was the sight of the sad and mournful parting, to hear what sighs and sobs and prayers did sound amongst them, what tears did gush from every eye, and pithy speeches pierced each other's hearts. With the weeping group, Fletcher left Alice and her attendants, while he went to the vessel to prepare for her suitable reception. He there found a clergyman, and bespoke his holy offices to unite him and his cousin immediately after their embarkation. All the necessary arrangements were made, and he was returning to the shore, his eyes fixed on the lovely being whom he believed heaven had interposed to give him, when he descried Sir William's carriage guarded by a cavalcade of men, in the uniform of the king's guards, approaching the spot where she stood. He comprehended at once their cruel purpose. He exhorted the boatmen to put forth all their natural strength. He seized the oars himself. Despair gave him supernatural power. The boat shot forward with the velocity of light, but all in vain. He only approached near enough to the shore to hear Alice's last impotent cries to him, to see her beautiful face convulsed with agony, and her arms outstretched toward him, when she was forced to the carriage by her father and driven from his sight. He leaped on the strand. He followed the troop with cries and entreaties, but he was only answered by the coarse jeering and profane jests of the soldiery. Notice was soon given that the boat was ready to return to the ship for the last time, and Fletcher, in a state of agitation and despair, almost amounting to insanity, permitted it to return without him. He went to London and requested an interview with his uncle. The request was granted, and a long and secret conference ensued. It was known by the servants of the household that their mistress, Alice, had been summoned by her father to this meeting, but what was said or done did not transpire. Immediately after, Fletcher returned to Mr. Winthrop's in Suffolk. The fixedness of despair was on his countenance, but he said nothing, even to this confidential friend, of the interview with his uncle. The particulars of the affair at Southampton, which had already reached Suffolk, seemed sufficiently to explain his misery. In less than a fortnight, he there received dispatches from his uncle, informing him that he had taken effectual measures to save himself from a second conspiracy against the honor of his family, that his daughter, Alice, had that day been led to the altar by Charles Leslie, and concluding with a polite hope that though his voyage had been interrupted, it might not be long deferred. Alice had, indeed, in the imbecility of utter despair, submitted to her father's commands. It was intimated at the time, and reported for many years after, that she had suffered a total alienation of mind. To the world this was never contradicted, for she lived in absolute retirement, but those who best knew could have attested that if her mind had departed from its beautiful temple, an angelic spirit had entered in and possessed it. William Fletcher was, in a few months, persuaded to unite himself with an orphan girl, a ward of Mr. Winthrop, who had, in the eyes of the elders, all the meek graces that befitted a godly maiden and dutiful helpmate. Fletcher remained constant to his purpose of emigrating to New England, but he did not effect it till the year 1630, when he embarked with his family and effects in the ship Arabella, with Governor Winthrop, who then, for the first time, went to that land where his name will ever be held in affectionate and honorable remembrance. End of chapter 1. Chapter 2 begins with a quotation from Roger Williams. "For the temper of the brain in quick apprehensions and acute judgments, to say no more, the most high and sovereign God hath not made the Indian inferior to the European." The magnitude of the enterprise in which the first settlers of New England were engaged, the terrific obstacles they encountered, and the hardships they endured, gave the characters a seriousness and solemnity heightened, it may be, by the severity of their religious faith. Where all were serious, the melancholy of an individual was not conspicuous, and Mr. Fletcher's sadness would probably have passed unnoticed, but for the reserve of his manners, which piqued the pride of his equals and provoked the curiosity of his inferiors. The first probably thought that the apostolic principle of community of goods at least extended to opinions and feelings, and the second always fancy when a man shuts the door of his lips that there must be some secret worth knowing within. Like many other men of an ardent temperament and disinterested love of his species, Mr. Fletcher was disappointed at the slow operation of principles which, however efficient and excellent in the abstract, were to be applied to various and discordant subjects. Such men, inexperienced in the business of life, are like children who, setting out on a journey, are impatient after the few first paces to be at the end of it. They cannot endure the rebuffs and delays that retard them in their course. These are the men of genius, the men of feeling, the men that the world call visionaries, and it is because they are visionaries, because they have a beau ideal in their own minds, to which they can see but a faint resemblance in the actual state of things, that they become impatient of detail, and cannot brook the slow progress to perfection. They are too rapid in their anticipations. The character of man, and the institutions of society, are yet very far from their possible and destined perfection. Still, how far is the present age in advance of that which drove reformers to a dreary wilderness, of that which hanged Quakers, of that which condemned death as witches, innocent, offending old women. But it is unnecessary to heighten the glory of our risen day by comparing it to the preceding twilight. To return to Mr. Fletcher. He was mortified at seeing power, which had been earned at so dear a rate, and which he had fondly hoped was to be applied to the advancement of man's happiness, sometimes perverted to purposes of oppression and personal aggrandizement. He was shocked when a religious republic, which he fancied to be founded on the basis of established truth, was disturbed by the outbreak of heresies, and his heart sickened when he saw those who had sacrificed whatever man holds dearest to religious freedom, imposing those shackles on others from which they had just released themselves at such a price. Partly influenced by these disgusts, and partly by that love of contemplation and retirement that belongs to a character of his caste, especially when depressed by some early disappointment, he refused the offices of honor and trust that were, from time to time, offered to him. And finally, in 1636, when Pynchon, Holyoake, and Chapin formed their settlement at Springfield, on Connecticut River, he determined to retire from the growing community of Boston to this frontier settlement. Mrs. Fletcher received his decision, as all wives of that age of undisputed masculine supremacy, or most of those of our less passive age, would do, with meek submission. These inconveniences and dangers of that outpost were not unknown to her, nor did she underrate them, but Abraham would as soon have remonstrated against the command that bade him go forth from his father's house into the land of the Chaldees, as she would have failed in passive obedience to the resolve of her husband. The removal was effected in the early summer of 1636. Springfield assumed, at once, under the auspices of its wealthy and enterprising proprietors, the aspect of a village. The first settlers followed the course of the Indians and planted themselves on the borders of the rivers, the natural gardens of the earth, where the soil is mellowed and enriched by the annual overflowing of the streams, and prepared by the unassisted processes of nature to yield to the indolent Indian his scanty supply of maize and other esculents. The wigwams, which constituted the village, or, to use the graphic Aboriginal designation, the smoke of the natives, gave place to the clumsy but more convenient dwellings of the pilgrims, where there are now contiguous rows of shops filled with the merchandise of the East, the manufactures of Europe, the rival fabrics of our own country, and the fruits of the tropics, where now stands the stately Hall of Justice, the Academy, the Bank, churches, Orthodox and Heretic, and all the symbols of a rich and populous community, were, at the early period of our history, a few log houses planted around a fort, defended by a slight embankment and palisade. The mansions of the proprietors were rather more spacious and artificial than those of their more humble associates, and were built on the well-known model of the modest dwelling illustrated by The Birth of Milton, a form still abounding in the eastern parts of Massachusetts, and presenting to the eye of a New Englander the familiar aspect of an awkward, friendly country cousin. The first clearing was limited to the plain. The beautiful hill that is now the residence of the gentry, for there yet lives such a class in the heart of our democratic community, and is embellished with stately edifices and expensive pleasure grounds, was then the border of a dense forest, and so richly fringed with the original growth of trees that scarce a sunbeam had penetrated to the parent earth. Mr. Fletcher was at first welcomed as an important acquisition to the infant establishment, but he soon proved that he purposed to take no part in its concerns, and in spite of the remonstrances of the proprietors, he fixed his residence a mile from the village, deeming exposure to the incursions of the savages very slight, and the surveillance of an inquiring neighborhood a certain evil. His domain extended from a gentle eminence, and commanded an extensive view of the bountiful Connecticut to the shore, where the river indented the meadow by one of those sweeping graceful curves by which it seems to delight to beautify the land it nourishes. The border of the river was fringed with all the water-loving trees, but the broad meadows were quite cleared, excepting that a few elms and sycamores had been spared by the Indians and consecrated, by tradition, as the scene of revels or councils. The house of our pilgrims was a low-roofed, modest structure, containing ample accommodation for a patriarchal family, where children, dependents, and servants were all to be sheltered under one roof tree. On one side, as we have described, lay an open and extensive plain. Within view was the curling smoke from the little cluster of houses about the fort, the habitation of civilized man, but all else was a savage, howling wilderness. Never was a name more befitting the condition of a people than Pilgrim, that of our forefathers. It should be redeemed from the puritanical and ludicrous associations which have degraded it in most men's minds, and be hallowed by the sacrifices made by these voluntary exiles. They were pilgrims, for they had resigned forever what the good hold most dear, their homes. Homes can never be transferred, never repeated in the experience of an individual. The place consecrated by parental love, by the innocence and sports of childhood, by the first acquaintance with nature, by the linking of the heart to the visible creation, is the only home. There is a living and breathing spirit infused into nature. Every familiar object has a history. The trees have tongues, and the very air is vocal. There the vesture of decay doth not close in and control the noble functions of the soul. It sees and hears and enjoys without the ministry of gross material substance. Mr. Fletcher had resided a few months in Springfield when he one day entered with an open letter in his hand that apartment of his humble dwelling styled by courtesy the parlor. His wife was sitting there with her eldest son, a stripling of 14, busily assisting him in twisting a cord for his crossbow. She perceived that her husband looked disturbed, but he said nothing, and her habitual deference prevented her inquiring into the cause of his discomposure. After taking two or three turns about the room, he said to his son, "Everil, my boy, go to the door and await there the arrival of an Indian girl. She is, as you may see, yonder by the riverside, and will be here shortly. I would not that Jennet should, at the very first, shock the child with her discourteous ways." "Child, come here," exclaimed the boy, dropping his bow and gazing through the window. "Who is she, that tall girl, father? She is no more a child than I am." His mother smiled at an exclamation that betrayed a common juvenile jealousy of the honor of dawning manhood, and bade the boy obey his father's directions. When Everil had left the apartment, Mr. Fletcher said, "I have just received letters from Boston, from Governor Winthrop." He paused. "Our friends are all well, I hope?" said Mrs. Fletcher. "Yes, Martha, our friends are all well. But these letters contain something of more importance than aught that concerns the health of the perishing body." Mr. Fletcher again hesitated, and his wife, perplexed by his embarrassment, inquired, "Has poor deluded Mrs. Hutchinson again presumed to disturb the peace of God's people?" "Martha, you aim wide of the mark. My present emotions are not those of a mourner for Zion. A ship has arrived from England, and in it came..." "My brother Stretton!" exclaimed Mrs. Fletcher. "No, no, Martha. It will be long ere Stretton quits his paradise to join a suffering people in the wilderness." He paused for a moment, and when he spoke again, the softened tone of his voice evinced that he was touched by the expression of disappointment, slightly tinged by displeasure, that shaded his wife's gentle countenance. "Forgive me, my dear wife. I should not have spoken aught that implied censure of your brother, for I know he hath ever been most precious in your eyes, albeit not the less so that he is yet without the fold. That which I have to tell you, and it were best that it were told quickly, is that my cousin Alice was a passenger in this newly arrived ship. Martha, your blushes wrong you. The mean jealousies that degrade some women have, I am sure, never been harbored in your heart. If I deserve your praise, it is because the Lord has been pleased to purify my heart and make it his sanctuary. But if I have not the jealousies, I have the feelings of a woman. And I cannot forget that you was once affianced to your cousin Alice, and that I told you once, Martha, frankly, that the affection I gave her could not be transferred to another. That love grew with my growth, strengthened with my strength. Of its beginning, I had no more consciousness than of the commencement of my existence. It was sunshine and flowers in all the paths of my childhood. It inspired every hope, modified every project. Such was the love I bore to Alice, love immortal as the soul. You know how cruelly we were severed at Southampton, how she was torn from the strand by the king's guards, within my view, almost within my grasp, how Sir William tempted me with the offer of pardon, my cousin's hand, and, poor temptation indeed after that, honors, fortune. You know that even Alice, my precious, beautiful Alice, knelt to me, that smitten of God and man, and for the moment, bereft of the right use of reason, she would have persuaded me to yield my integrity. You know that her cruel father reproached me with virtually breaking my plighted troth, that many of my friends urged my present conformity, and you know, Martha, that there was a principle in my bosom that triumphed over all these temptations. And think you not that principle has preserved me faithful in my friendship to you? Think you not that your obedience, your careful conformity to my wishes, your steady love, which hath kept far more than even measure with my deserts, is undervalued, can be lightly estimated? Oh, I know, said the humble wife, that your goodness to me does far surpass my merit. But bethink you, it is the nature of a woman to crave the first place. It is the right of a wife, Martha, and there is none now to contest it with you. This is but the second time I have spoken to you on a subject that has been much in our thoughts, that has made me wayward, and would have made my sojourning on earth miserable, but that you have been my support and comforter. These letters contain tidings that have opened a long-sealed fountain. My uncle, Sir William, died in January. Leslie perished in a foreign service. Alice, thus released from all bonds, and sole mistress of her fortunes, determined to cast her lot in the heritage of God's people. She embarked with her two girls, her only children. A tempestuous voyage proved too much for a constitution already broken by repeated shocks. She was fully aware of her approaching death, and died as befits a child of faith, in sweet peace. Would to God I could have seen her once more, but, he added, raising his eyes devoutly, not my will but thine be done. The sister of Leslie, a Mistress Grafton, attended Alice, and with her she left a will committing her children to my guardianship. It will be necessary for me to go to Boston to assume this trust. I shall leave home tomorrow, after making suitable provision for your safety and comfort in my absence. These children will bring additional labor to your household, and in good time hath our thoughtful friend Governor Winthrop procured for us two Indian servants. The girl has arrived. The boy is retained about the little Leslies, the youngest of whom, it seems, is a petted child, and is particularly pleased by his activity in ministering to her amusements. I am glad if any use can be made of an Indian servant, said Mrs. Fletcher, who, oppressed with conflicting emotions, expressed the lightest of them, a concern at a sudden increase of domestic cares where there were no facilities to lighten them. How any use? You surely do not doubt, Martha, that these Indians possess the same faculties that we do. The girl just arrived, our friend writes me, hath rare gifts of mind, such as few of God's creatures are endowed with. She is just 15. She understands and speaks English perfectly well, having been taught it by an English captive who for a long time dwelt with her tribe. On that account, she was much noticed by the English who traded with the Pequods, and young as she was, she acted as their interpreter. She is the daughter of one of their chiefs, and when this wolfish tribe were killed or dislodged from their dens, she, her brother, and their mother were brought with a few other captives to Boston. They were given for a spoil to the soldiers. Some, by a Christian use of the money, were redeemed, and others, I blush to say it, for it is God's gift that every man should enjoy the good of his own labor, were sent into slavery in the West Indies. Minoka, the mother of these children, was noted for the singular dignity and modesty of her demeanor. Many notable instances of her kindness to the white traders are recorded, and when she was taken to Boston, our worthy governor, ever mindful of his duties, assured her that her good deeds were held in remembrance, and that he would testify the gratitude of his people in any way that she should direct. I have nothing to ask, she said, but that I and my children may receive no personal dishonor. The governor redeemed her children, and assured her that they should be cared for. For herself, misery and sorrow had so wrought on her that she was fast sinking into the grave. Many Christian men and women labored for her conversion, but she would not even consent that the Holy Word should be interpreted to her, insisting in the pride of her soul that all the children of the Great Spirit were equal objects of his favor, and that he had not deemed the book he had withheld needful to them. And did she, inquired Mrs. Fletcher, thus perish in her sins? She died, replied her husband, immovably fixed in those sentiments. But, Martha, we should not suit God's mercy to the narrow frame of our thoughts. This poor savage's life, as far as it comes to our knowledge, was marked with innocence and good deeds. I would gladly believe that we may hope for her, on that broad foundation laid by the Apostle Peter. In every nation, he that feareth God and worketh righteousness is accepted of him. That text, answered Mrs. Fletcher, her heart easily kindling with the flame of charity, is a light behind many a dark scripture. like the sun shining all around the edges of a cloth that would fain hide its beams. Such thoughts, my dear wife, naturally spring from thy kind heart, and are sweet morsels for private meditation, but it were well to keep them in thine own bosom, lest, taking breath, they should lighten the fears of unstable souls. But here comes the girl, Megawiska, clothed in her Indian garb, which the governor has permitted her to retain, not caring, as he wisely says, to interfere with their innocent peculiarities, and she, in particular, having shown loathing of the English dress. Everil Fletcher now threw wide open the parlor door, inviting the Indian girl, by a motion of his hand and a kind smile, to follow. She did so, and remained standing beside him, with her eyes riveted to the floor, while every other eye was turned towards her. She and her conductor were no unfit representatives of the people from whom they sprung. Everil Fletcher was a fair ruddy boy of 14. His smooth brow and bright curling hair bore the stamp of the morning of life. Hope and confidence and gladness beamed in the falcon glance of his keen blue eye, and love and frolic played about his lips. The active, hearty habits of life in a new country had already knit his frame and given him the muscle of manhood, while his quick, elastic step truly expressed the untamed spirit of childhood, the only spirit without fear and without reproach. His dress was of blue cloth, closely fitting his person. The sleeves reached midway between the elbow and wrist, and the naked, as it would seem to a modern eye, awkward space was garnished with deep pointed lace ruffles of coarse texture. A ruff or collar of the same material was worn about the neck. The Indian stranger was tall for her years, which did not exceed 15. Her form was slender, flexible, and graceful, and there was a freedom and loftiness in her movement which, though tempered with modesty, expressed a consciousness of high birth. Her face, although marked by the peculiarities of her race, was beautiful even to an European eye. Her features were regular, and her teeth white as pearls, but there must be something beyond symmetry of feature to fix the attention, and it was an expression of dignity, thoughtfulness, and deep dejection that made the eye linger on Magawiska's face, as if it was perusing there the legible record of her birth and wrongs. Her hair, contrary to the fashion of the Massachusetts Indians, was parted on her forehead, braided, and confined to her head by a band of small feathers, jet black, and interwoven, and attached at equal distances by rings of polished bone. She wore a waistcoat of deerskin, fashioned at the throat by a richly wrought collar. Her arms, a model for sculpture, were bare. A mantle of purple cloth hung gracefully from her shoulders, and it was confined at the waist by a broad band ornamented with rude hieroglyphics. The mantle and her straight short petticoat or kilt of the same rare and costly material had been obtained, probably, from the English traders. Stockings were an unknown luxury, but leggings, similar to those worn by the ladies of Queen Elizabeth's court, were no bad substitute. The moccasin, neatly fitted to a delicate foot and ankle, and tastefully ornamented with beadwork, completed the apparel of this daughter of a chieftain, which altogether had an air of wild and fanatic grace that harmonized well with the noble demeanor and peculiar beauty of the young savage. Mr. Fletcher surveyed her for a moment with a mingled feeling of compassion and curiosity, and then turning away and leaning his head on the mantelpiece, his thoughts reverted to the subject that had affected him far more deeply than he had ventured to confess, even to the wife of his bosom. Mrs. Fletcher's first feeling was rather that of a housewife than a tender woman. "My husband," she thought, "might as well have brought a wild doe from the forest to plow his fields as to give me this Indian girl for household labor. But the wisest men have no sense in these matters." This natural domestic reflection was soon succeeded by a sentiment of compassion, which scarcely needed to be stimulated by Everil's whisper of, "Do, mother, speak to her." "Megawiska," she said in a friendly tone, "you are welcome among us, girl." Megawiska bowed her head. Mrs. Fletcher continued, "You should receive it as a signal mercy, child, that you have been taken from the midst of a savage people and set in a Christian family." Mrs. Fletcher paused for her auditor's assent, but the proposition was either unintelligible or unacceptable to Magawiska. "Mistress Fletcher means," said a middle-aged serving woman who had just entered the room, "that you should be mightily thankful, Tawny, that you are snatched as a brand from the burning." "Hush, Jeanette," said Everil Fletcher, touching the speaker with the point of an arrow which he held in his hand. Megawiska's eyes had turned on Jeanette, flashing like a sunbeam through an opening cloud. Everil's interposition touched a tender chord, and when she again cast them down, a tear trembled on their lids. "You will have no hard service to do," said Mrs. Fletcher, resuming her address. "I cannot explain all to you now, but you will soon perceive that our civilized life is far easier, far better, and happier than your wild wandering ways, which are indeed, as you will presently see, but little superior to those of the wolves and foxes." Megawiska suppressed a reply that her heart sent to her quivering lips, and Everil said, "Hunted as the Indians are, to their own dens, I'm sure, mother, they need the fierceness of the wolf and the cunning of the fox." "True, true, my son," replied Mrs. Fletcher, who really meant no unkindness in expressing what she deemed a self-evident truth. And then turning again to Magawiska, she said in a gentle tone, "You have had a long and fatiguing journey, was it not, girl?" "My foot," replied Magawiska, "is used to the wild wood path. The deer tires not of his way on the mountain, nor the bird of its flight in the air." She uttered her natural feeling in so plaintive a tone that it touched the heart like a strain of sad music, and when Jeanette again officiously interposed in the conversation by saying that, "Truly, these savages have their house in the wilderness, and their way no man knows," her mistress cut short her outpouring by directing her to go to the outer door and learn who it was who Digby was conducting to the house. A moment after, Digby, Mr. Fletcher's confidential domestic, entered with the air of one who has important intelligence to communicate. He was followed by a tall, gaunt Indian, who held in his hand a deerskin pouch. "Ha, Digby," said Mr. Fletcher, "have you returned? What say the commissioners? Can they furnish me a guide and attendance for my journey?" "Yes, and please you, sir, I was in the nick of time, for they were just dispatching a messenger to the governor." "On what account?" "Why, it's a rather odd errand," replied Digby, scratching his head with an awkward hesitation. "I would not wish to shock my gentle mistress, which will never bring her feelings to the queer fashions of the new world. But Lord's mercy, sir, you know we think no more of taking off a scalp here than we did of shaving our beards at home." "Scalp!" exclaimed Mr. Fletcher. "Explain yourself, Digby." The Indian, as if to assist Digby's communication, untied his pouch and withdrew from it a piece of dried and shriveled skin, to which hair, matted together with blood, still adhered. There was an expression of fierce triumph on the countenance of the savage as he surveyed the trophy with the grim smile. A murmur of indignation burst from all present. "Why did you bring that wretch here?" demanded Mr. Fletcher of his servant in an angry tone. "I did but obey Mr. Pynchon, sir. The thing is an abomination to the soul and eye of a Christian, but it has to be taken to Boston for the reward." "What reward, Digby?" "The reward, sir, that is in reason expected for the scalp of the Pequot chief." As Digby uttered these words, Magawiska shrieked as if a dagger had pierced her heart. She darted forward and grasped the arm that upheld the trophy. "My father, Mononado," she screamed in a voice of agony. "Give it to her, by heaven, you shall give it to her," cried Everil, springing on the Indian and losing all other thought in his instinctive sympathy for Magawiska. "Softly, softly, Mr. Everil," said Digby. "That is the scalp of Sassacus, not Mononado. The Pequots had two chiefs, you know." Magawiska now released her hold, and as soon as she could again command her voice, she said in her own language to the Indian, my father, does he live? He does, answered the Indian in the same dialect. He lives in the wigwam of the chief of the Mohawks. Mugawiska was silent for a moment and knit her brows as agitated with an important deliberation. She then undid a bracelet from her arm and gave it to the chieftain. I charge ye, she said, as ye hope for game in your hunting grounds, for the sun on your wigwam, and the presence of the Great Spirit on your death hour, I charge ye to convey this token to my father. Tell him his children are servants in the house of his enemies, but, she added, after a moment's pause, to whom am I trusting? To the murderer of Sassacus? My father's friend? Fear not, replied the Indian. Your errand shall be done. Sassacus was a strange tree in our forests, but he struck his root deep and lifted his head high above our loftiest branches and cast his shadow over us, and I cut him down. I may not return to my people, for they called Sassacus brother, and they would fain avenge him. But fear not, maiden, your errand shall be done. Mr. Fletcher observed this conference, which he could not understand, with some anxiety and displeasure, and he broke it off by directing Jeanette to conduct Magawiska to another apartment. Jeanette obeyed, muttering as she went, a notable providence this concerning the Pequod caitiff, even like Adon Bezek, as he had done to others the Lord hath requited him. Mr. Fletcher then most reluctantly took into his possession the savage trophy and dismissed the Indian, deeply lamenting that motives of mistaken policy should tempt his brethren to depart from the plainest principles of their religion. End of chapter 2. Chapter 3 begins with a quotation from the Fairy Queen. But ah, who can deceive his destiny, or wean by warning to avoid his fate? On the following morning, Mr. Fletcher set out for Boston, and escaping all perils by flood and field, he arrived there at the expiration of 9 days, having accomplished the journey, now the affair of a single day, with unusual expedition. His wards were accompanied by 2 individuals who were now with them to become permanent members of his family. Mrs. Grafton, the sister of their father, and one Mr. Craddock, a scholar skilled in the tongues, who attended them as their tutor. Mrs. Grafton was a widow, far on the shady side of 50, though, as that was a subject to which she never alluded, she probably regarded age with the feeling ascribed to her sex, that being the last quality for which womankind would wish to be honored, as is said by one whose satire is so good-humored that even its truth may be endured. She was, unhappily for herself as her lot was cast, a zealous adherent to the Church of England. Good people, who take upon themselves the supervisorship of their neighbors' consciences, abounded in that age, and from them Mrs. Grafton received frequent exhortations and remonstrances. To these she uniformly replied that a faith and mode of religion that had saved so many was good enough to save her, that she had received her belief just as it was from her father, and he, not she, was responsible for it. Offensive such opinions must needs be in a community of professed reformers, but the good lady did not make them more so by the obtrusiveness of overwrought zeal. To confess the truth, her mind was far more intent on the reforms of headpieces than modes of faith. She was far more ambitious of being the leader of fashion than the leader of a sect. She would have contended more earnestly for a favorite recipe than a favorite dogma. And though she undoubtedly believed a saint in crape to be twice a saint in lawn, and fearlessly maintained that no man could suitably administer the offices of religion without gown, surplice, and wig, yet she chiefly directed her hostilities against the puritanical attire of the ladies of the colony, who, she insisted, did most unnaturally belie their nature as women, and their birth and bringing up as gentlewomen, by their ill-fashioned, ill-sorted, and unbecoming apparel. To this heresy she was fast gaining proselytes, for, if we may believe the simple cobbler of Agawam, there were, even in those early and pure days, Nugiparous gentle dames who inquired what dress the queen is in this week. The contagion spread rapidly, and when some of the most vigilant and zealous sentinels proposed that the preacher should make it the subject of public and personal reproof, it was whispered that the scandal was not limited to idle maidens, but that certain of the deacon's wives were in it, and it was deemed more prudent to adopt gentle and private measures to eradicate the evil, an evil so deeply felt as to be bewailed by the merciless cobbler, above quoted, in the following affecting terms: "Methinks it would break the hearts of Englishmen to see so many goodly English women imprisoned in French cages, peeping out of their hood holes for some men of mercy to help them with a little wit, and nobody relieves them. We have about 5 or 6 of them in our colony. If I see any of them accidentally, I cannot cleanse my fancy of them for a month after." It would seem marvelous that a woman like Mrs. Grafton, apparently engrossed in the world, living on the foam and froth of life, should become a voluntary exile to the colonies. But, to do her justice, she was kind-hearted and affectionate, susceptible of strong and controlling attachment, and the infant children of a brother on whom she had doted outweighed her love of frivolous pleasures and personal indulgence. She certainly believed that the resolution of her sister to go to the wilderness had no parallel in the history of human folly and madness, but the resolution once taken, and, as she perceived, unconquerable, she made her own destiny conformable, not without some restiveness, but without serious repining. It was an unexpected shock to her to be compelled to leave Boston for a condition of life not only more rude and inconvenient, but really dangerous. Necessity, however, is more potent than philosophy, and Mrs. Grafton, like most people, submitted with patience to an inevitable evil. As good Mr. Craddock was a man rather acted upon than acting, we shall leave him to be discovered by our readers as the light of others falls on him. Mr. Fletcher received the children, the relics and gifts of a woman whom he had loved as few men can love, with an intense interest. The youngest, Mary, was a pretty petted child, wayward and bashful. She repelled Mr. Fletcher's caresses, and ran away to shelter herself in her aunt's arms. But Alice, eldest, seemed instinctively to return the love that beamed in the first glance that Mr. Fletcher cast on her. In that brief, eager glance, he saw the living and beautiful image of her mother. So much was he impressed with the resemblance that he said in a letter to his wife that it reminded him of the heathen doctrine of metempsychosis, and he could almost believe the spirit of the mother was transferred to the bosom of the child. The arrangement Mr. Fletcher made for the transportation of his charge to Springfield might probably be traced to the preference inspired by this resemblance. He dispatched the little Mary with her aunt and the brother of Magawiska, the Indian boy Oniko, and such attendants as were necessary for their safe conduct, and he retained Alice and the tutor to be companions of his journey. Before the children were separated, they were baptized by the Reverend Mr. Cotton, and in commemoration of the Christian graces of their mother, their names were changed to the puritanical appellations of Hope and Faith. Mr. Fletcher was detained, at first by business and afterwards by ill health, much longer than he had expected, and the fall, winter, and earliest months of spring wore away before he was able to set his face homeward. In the meantime, his little community at Bethel proceeded more harmoniously than could have been hoped from the discordant materials of which it was composed. This was owing in great part to the wise and gentle Mrs. Fletcher. The son of her little system, all were obedient to the silent influence that controlled without being perceived, but a letter which she wrote to Mr. Fletcher just before his return, containing some important domestic details, may be deemed worth the reprisal of our readers. Beginning of the letter, dated Springfield, 1636. To my good and honored husband, thy kind letter was duly received 14 days after date, and was most welcome to me, containing, as it does, a portion of that stream of kindness that is ever flowing out from thy bountiful nature towards me. Sweet and refreshing was it, as these gentle days of spring after our sullen winter. Winter, ever disconsolate in these parts, but made tenfold more dreary by the absence of that precious light by which I have been cheered and guided. I thank ye heartily, my dear life, that thou dost so warmly commend my poor endeavors to do well in thy absence. I have truly tried to be faithful to my little nestlings, and to cheer them with notes of gladness when I have dropped inwardly for the voice of my mate. Yet my anxious thoughts have been more with thee than with myself, nor have I been unmindful of any of thy perplexities by sickness and otherwise. But in all thy troubles I have been troubled, and have ever prayed, that whatever might betide me, thou mightest return in safety to thy desiring family. I have had many difficulties to contend with in thy absence, of which I have forborne to inform thee, deeming it the duty of a wife never to disquiet her husband with her household cares. But now that, with the Lord's permission, thou art so soon to be with us, I would fain render unto thee an account of my stewardship, knowing that thou art not a hard master, and wilt consider the will and not the weakness of thy loving wife. This Dame Grafton is strangely out of place here, fitter for a parlor bird than a flight into the wilderness. But that she cometh commended to us as a widow, a name that is a draught from the Lord upon every Christian heart, we might find it hard to brook her light and worldly ways. She raileth, and yet I think not with an evil mind, but rather ignorantly, at our most precious faith, and hath even ventured to read aloud from her book of common prayer, an offence that she hath not been prevented from repeating by the somewhat profane jest of our son Everil, whose love of mischief, proceeding from the gay temper of youth, I trust you will overlook. It was a few nights ago, when a storm was raging, that the poor lady's fears were gently excited. My womanish apprehensions had a hard struggle with my duty, so terrific was the hideous howling of the wolves, mingling with the blasts that swept through the forest, but I stilled my beating heart with the thought that my children leant on me, and I must not betray my weakness. But Dame Grafton was beside herself. At one moment she fancied we should be the prey of the wild beast, and at the next she heard the alarm yell of the savages. Everil brought her her prayer book, and affecting a well-beseeming gravity, he begged her to look out the prayer for distressed women in imminent danger of being scalped by North American Indians. The poor lady, distracted with terror, seized the book and turned over leaf after leaf, Everil meanwhile affecting to aid her search. In vain I shook my head reprovingly at the boy. In vain I assured Mistress Grafton that I trusted we were in no danger. She was beyond the influence of reason. Nothing allayed her fears, till chancing to catch a glance of Everil's eye, she detected the lurking laughter, and rapping him soundly over the ears with her book, she left the room greatly enraged. I grieve to add that Everil evinced small sorrow for his levity, though I admonished him thereupon. At the same time I thought it a fit occasion to commend the sagacity whereby he had detected the shortcomings of written prayers, and to express my hope that, unpromising as his beginnings are, he may prove a son of Jacob that shall wrestle and prevail. I have something farther to say of Everil, who is, in the main, a most devoted son, and is, I believe, an apt scholar, as his master telleth me that he readeth Latin like his mother tongue, and is well grounded in the Greek. The boy doth greatly affect the company of the Pequod girl, Magawisca. If, in his studies, he meets with any trait of heroism, and with such, truly, her mind doth seem naturally to assimilate, he straightway calleth for her and rendereth it into English, in which she hath made such marvellous project, that I am sometimes startled with the beautiful forms in which she clothes her simple thoughts. She, in her turn, doth take much delight in describing to him the customs of her people, in relating their traditionary tales, which are like pictures captivating to a youthful imagination. He hath taught her to read, and reads to her Spenser's Rhymes, and many other books of the like kind, of which I am sorry to say Dame Grafton hath brought hither stores. I have not forbidden him to read them, well knowing that the appetite of youth is often whetted by denial, and fearing that the boy might be tempted secretly to evade my authority, I would rather expose him to all the mischief of this unprofitable lore than to tempt him to a deceit that might corrupt the sweet fountain of truth, the wellspring of all that is good and noble. I've gone far from my subject. When my boy comes before my mind's eye, I can see no other object. But to return, I have not been unmindful of my duty to the Indian girl, but have endeavored to instill into her mind the first principles of our religion, as contained in Mr. Cotton's catechism and elsewhere. But alas, to these her eye is shut and her ear is closed, not only with that blindness and deafness common to natural man, but she entertaineth an aversion which she has fixedness in principle, and doth continually remind me of Hannibal's hatred to Rome, and is like that inwrought with her filial piety. I have, in vain, attempted to subdue her to the drudgery of domestic service, and make her take part with Jeanette, but as hopefully might you yoke a deer with an ox. It is not that she lacks obedience to me. So far as it seems she can command her duty, she is ever complying. But it appeareth impossible to her to clip the wings of her soaring thoughts, and to keep them down to household matters. I have sometimes marveled at the providence of God in bestowing on this child of the forest such rare gifts of mind, and other and outward beauties. Her voice hath a natural deep and most sweet melody in it, far beyond any stringed instrument. She hath too, think not that I, like Everil, am, as Jeanette saith, a charmed bird to her. She hath, though yet a child in years, that in her mien that doth bring to mind the lofty Judith and the gracious Esther. When I once said this to Everil, he replied, O mother, is she not more like the gentle and tender Ruth? To him she may be, and therefore it is that innocent and safe as the intercourse of these children now is, it is for thee to decide whether it not be most wise to remove the maiden from our dwelling. Two young plants that have sprung up in close neighborhood may be separated while young, but if disjoined after their fibers are all intertwined, one, or perchance both, may perish. Think not that this anxiety springs from the mistaken fancy of a woman, that love is the natural channel for all the purposes and thoughts and hopes and feelings of human life. Neither think, I beseech thee, that doting with a foolish fondness upon my noble boy, I magnify into importance whatsoever concerneth him. No, my heart yearneth toward this poor heathen orphan girl, and when I see her in his absence, starting at every sound, and her restless eye turning an asking glance at every opening of the door, every movement betokening a disquieted spirit, and then the sweet contentment that stealeth over her face when he appeareth, O my honored husband, all my woman's nature feeleth for her, not for any present evil, but for what may betide. Having commended this subject to thy better wisdom, I leave caring for it to speak to thee of others of thy household. Your three little girls are thriving mightily, and as to the baby, you will not be ashamed to own him, though you will not recognize in the bouncing boy that plays bo peep and creeps quite over the room the little creature who had scarcely opened his eyes to the world when you went away. He is by far the largest child I ever had, and the most knowing. He has cut his front upper teeth, and he showeth signs of two more. He is surprisingly fond of Onico, and clappeth his hands with joy whenever he sees him. Indeed, the boy is a favorite with all the young ones, and greatly aided me by continually pleasuring them. He is far different from his sister, gay and volatile, giving scarcely one thought to the past, and not one care to the future. His sister often taketh him apart to discourse with him, and sometimes doth produce a cast of seriousness over his countenance, but at the next presented object it vanisheth as speedily as a shadow before a sunbeam. He hath commended himself greatly to the favor of Dame Grafton by his devotion to her little favorite. A spoiled child is she, and it seemeth a pity that the name of Faith was given to her, since her shrinking, timid character doth not promise in any manner to resemble that most potent of the Christian graces. Oniko hath always some charm to lure her waywardness. He bringeth home the treasures of the woods to please her, berries and wild flowers, and the beautiful plumage of birds that are brought down by his unerring aim. Everil hath much advantage from the woodcraft of Oniko. The two boys daily enrich our table, which, in truth, had need of such helps, with the spoils of the air and water. I am grieved to tell you that some misrule hath crept in among thy servants in thy absence. Alas, what are sheep without their shepherd? Digby is, as ever, faithful, not serving with eye service, but Hutton hath consorted much with some evildoers who have been violating the law of God and the law of our land by meeting together in merry companies, playing cards, dancing, and the like. For these offences they were brought before Mr. Pynchon, and he sentenced to receive each 20 stripes well laid on. Hutton, furthermore, having been overtaken with drink, was condemned to wear, suspended around his neck for 1 month, a bit of wood on which Toper is legibly written, and Darby, who was ever a dawdler, having gone last Saturday with the cart to the village, dilly-dallied about there, and did not set out on his return till the sun was quite down, both to the eye and by the calendar. Accordingly, early on the following Monday, he was summoned before Mr. Pynchon and ordered to receive 10 stripes, but by reason of his youth and my intercession, which, being by a private letter, doubtless had some effect, the punishment was remitted, whereby he heartily promised amendment and a better carriage. There hath been some alarm here within the past few days on account of certain Indians who have been seen lurking in the woods around us. They are reported not to have a friendly appearance. We have been advised to remove, for the present, to the fort. But as I feel no apprehension, I shall not disarrange my family by taking a step that would savor more of fear than prudence. I say I feel no apprehension, yet I must confess it, I have a cowardly womanish spirit, and fear is set in motion by the very mention of danger. There are vague forebodings hanging about me, and I cannot drive them away even by the thought that your presence, my honored husband, will soon relieve me from all agitating apprehensions, and repair all the faults of my poor judgment. Fearful thoughts press on me. Untoward accidents have prolonged thy absence. Our reunion may yet be far distant, and if it should never chance in this world, oh, remember that I have fallen far short in duty, the measure of my love hath been full. I have ever known that mine was Leah's portion, that I was not the chosen and the loved one, and this has sometimes made me fearful, often joyless. But remember, it is only the perfect love of the husband that casteth out the fear of the wife. I have one request to prefer to thee, which I have lacked courage to make by word of mouth, and therefore now commend it by letter to thy kindness. Be gracious unto me, my dear husband, and deem not that I overstep the modest bound of a woman's right in meddling with that which is thy prerogative, the ordering of our eldest son's education. Everil here hath few except spiritual privileges. God, who seeth my heart, knoweth I do not undervalue these, the manna of the wilderness. Yet to them might be added worldly helps. To aid the growth of the boy's noble gifts, a kind providence having opened a wide door, therefore in the generous offer to my brother Stretton. True, he hath not attained our light, whereby manifold errors of church and state are made visible. Yet he hath ever borne himself uprightly, and to us most lovingly, and as I remember there was a good Samaritan and a faithful centurion. I think we are permitted to enlarge the bounds of our charity to those who work righteousness, albeit not of our communion. Thou hast already sown the good seed of our boy's heart, and it hath been, I say it not presumingly, nurtured with a mother's tears and prayers. Trust, then, to the promised blessing, and fear not to permit him to pass a few years in England, whence he will return to be a crown of glory to thee, my husband, and a blessing and honor to our chosen country. Importunity, I know, and not beseeming in a wife, it is the instrument of weakness whereby, like a mouse in the fable, she would gnaw away what she cannot break. I will not, therefore, urge thee farther, but leave the decision to thy wisdom and thy love. And now, my dear husband, I kiss and embrace thee, and may God company with thee, and restore thee, if it be his good pleasure, to thy ever faithful and loving and obedient wife, Martha Fletcher. To her honored husband, these be delivered. The above letter may indicate, but it feebly expresses, the character and state of the mind of the writer. She never magnified her love by words, but expressed it by that self-devoting, self-sacrificing conduct to her husband and children, which characterizes, in all ages and circumstances, faithful and devoted woman. She was too generous to communicate all her fears, about which a woman is usually least reserved, to her husband. Some occurrences of the preceding day had given her just cause of alarm. At a short distance from Bethel, the name that Mr. Fletcher had given his residence, there lived an old Indian woman, one of the few survivors of a tribe who had been faithful allies of the Pequods. After the destruction of her people, she had strayed up the banks of the Connecticut and remained in Springfield. She was in the habit of supplying Mrs. Fletcher with wild berries and herbs, and receiving favors in return, and on that day went thither, as it appeared, on her customary errand. She had made her usual barter, and she had drawn her blanket around her as if to depart, but she still lingered, standing around Mrs. Fletcher, and looked fixedly at her. Mrs. Fletcher did not at first observe her. Her head was bent over her infant sleeping on her lap, in the attitude of listening to its soft breathing. As she perused its innocent face, a mother's beautiful visions floated before her. But as she raised her eye and met the piercing glance of the old woman, a dark cloud came over the clear heaven of her thoughts. Nalima's brow was contracted, her lips drawn in, and her little sunken eye gleamed like a diamond from its dark recess. "Why do you look at my baby thus?" asked Mrs. Fletcher. The old woman replied in her own dialect, in a hurried, inarticulate manner. "What says she, Magawiska?" asked Mrs. Fletcher of the Indian girl who stood beside her, and seemed to listen with unwonted interest. "She says, madame, the baby is like a flower just opened to the sun, with no stain upon it, that he better pass now to the Great Spirit. She says this world is all a rough place, all sharp stones and deep waters and black clouds. Oh, she is old, Magawiska, and the days have come to her that have no pleasure in them. Look there," she said, "Nalima, at my son Everil." The boy was at the moment passing the window, flushed with exercise and triumphantly displaying a string of game that he had just brought from the forest. "Is there not sunshine in my boy's face? To him every day is bright, and every path is smooth." "Ah," replied the old woman with a heavy groan, "I had sons too, and grandsons, but where are they? They trod the earth as lightly as that boy, but they have fallen like our forest trees before the stroke of the English axe. Of all my race, there is not one now in whose veins my blood runs. Sometimes, when the spirits of the storm are howling about my wigwam, I hear the voices of my children crying for vengeance, and then I could myself deal the death blow." Nalima spoke with vengeance and wild gesture, and her language, though interpreted by Magawiska's soft voice, had little tendency to allay the feeling her manner inspired. Mrs. Fletcher recoiled from her, and instinctively drew her baby closer to her breast. "Nay," said the old woman, "fear me not. I have had kindness from thee, thy blankets have warmed me, I have been fed from thy table, and drank of thy cup, and what is this arm?" And she threw back her blanket and stretched out her naked, shriveled, trembling arm. "What is this to do the work of vengeance?" She paused for an instant, glanced her eye wildly around the room, and then fixed it on Mrs. Fletcher and her infant. "They spared not our homes," she said. "There where our old men spoke, where was heard the song of the maiden, and the laugh of our children, there now all is silence, dust, and ashes. I can neither harm thee nor help thee. When the stream of vengeance rolls over the land, the tender shoot must be broken, and the goodly tree uprooted, that gave its pleasant shade and fruits to all." "It is a shame and a sin," said Jeanette, who entered the room just as Magawiska was conveying Nalima's speech to Mrs. Fletcher. "A crying shame for this heathen hag to be pouring forth here as if she were gifted like the prophets of old. She can only see into the future by reading the devil's book, and if that be the case, as more than one has mistrusted, it were best forthwith to deliver her to the judges and cast her into prison. Peace, Jeanette, said Mrs. Fletcher, alarmed lest Nalima should hear her, and her feelings, which were already at an exalted pitch, should be wrought to frenzy. But her apprehensions were groundless. The old woman saw nothing but the visions of her imagination, heard nothing but the fancied voices of the spirits of her race. She continued for a few moments to utter her thoughts in low, inarticulate murmurs, and then, without again addressing Mrs. Fletcher or raising her eyes, she left the house. A few moments after her departure, Mrs. Fletcher perceived that she had dropped at her feet a little roll which she had found on examination to be an arrow, and the rattle of a rattlesnake enveloped in a skin of the same reptile. She knew it was the custom of the savages to express much meaning by these symbols, and she turned to demand an explanation from Magawiska, who was deeply skilled in all the ways of her people. Magawiska had disappeared, and Jeanette, who had ever looked on the poor girl with a jealous and evil eye, took this occasion to give vent to her feelings. "It is a pity," she said. "The child is out of the way the first time she was like to do a service. She may be skilled in snakes' rattles and bloody arrows, for I make no doubt she is used to them, as I am to my broom and scrubbing cloth." "Will you call Magawiska to me?" said Mrs. Fletcher, in a voice that from her would have been silencing reproof to a more sensitive ear than Jeanette's. But she, no ways daunted, replied, "Ah, that will I, madam, if I can find her. But where to look for her no mere mortal can tell, for she does not stay longer on the perch than a butterfly, unless, indeed, it be when she is working on Mr. Everill's moccasins, or filling his ears with wild fables about those rampaging Indians." "Ah, there she is," she exclaimed, looking through the window, "talking with Nalima, just a little way in the wood. There, I see their heads above those scrub oaks. See their wild motions. See Magawiska starts homeward. Now the old woman pulls her back. Now she seems entreating Nalima. The old hag shakes her head. Magawiska covers her ears. What can all this mean? No good, I am sure. The girl is ever going to Nalima's hut, and of moonlight nights too, when they say witches work their will. Birds of a feather flock together. Well, I know one thing, that if Master Everill was mine, I would sooner in faith cast him into the lion's den, or the fiery furnace, than leave him to this crafty offspring of a race that are the children and heirs of the evil one." "Jeanette," said Mrs. Fletcher, "thy tongue far outruns thy discretion. Restrain thy foolish thoughts, and bid Magawiska come to me." Jeanette sullenly obeyed, and soon after Magawiska entered. Mrs. Fletcher was struck with her changed aspect. She turned away, as one conscious of possessing a secret, and fearful that the eye, the herald of the soul, will speak unbidden. Her air was troubled and anxious, and instead of her usual light and lofty step, she moved timidly and dejectedly. "Come to me, Magawiska," said Mrs. Fletcher, "and deal truly by me, as I have ever dealt by thee." She obeyed, and as she stood by Mrs. Fletcher, the poor girl's tears dropped on her benefactor's lap. "Thou hast been more than true," she said. "Thou hast been kind to me as a mother bird that shelters the wanderer in her nest." Then Magawiska, "If it concerneth me to know it, thou wilt explain the meaning of this roll which Nalima dropped at my feet." The girl started and became very pale. To an observing eye, the changes of the olive skin are as apparent to those of a fairer complexion. She took the roll from Mrs. Fletcher and shut her eyes fast. Her bosom heaved convulsively, but after a short struggle with conflicting feelings, she said deliberately in a low voice, "That which I may speak without bringing down on me the curse of my father's race, I will speak. This," she added, unfolding the snake skin, "this betokeneth the unseen and silent approach of an enemy. This, you know," she held up the rattle, "is the warning voice that speaketh of danger near. And this," she concluded, taking the arrow in her trembling hand, "is the symbol of death." "And why, Magawiska, are these fearful tokens given to me? Dost thou know, girl, aught of a threatening enemy, of an ambushed foe?" I have said all I may say, she replied. Mrs. Fletcher questioned further, but could not obtain satisfaction. Magawiska's lips were sealed, and it was certain that, if her resolution did not yield to the entreaties of her own heart, it would resist every other influence. Mrs. Fletcher summoned Everill, and bade him urge Magawiska to disclose whatever Nalima had communicated. He did so, but sportively, for, he said, the old woman was cracked, and Magawiska's head was turned. If there were indeed danger, he continued, and Magawiska was apprised of it, think you, mother, she would permit us to remain in ignorance? He turned an appealing glance to Magawiska, but her face was averted. Without suspecting this was intentional, he continued, you ought to do penance, Magawiska, for the alarm you have given mother. You and I will act as her patrol tonight. Magawiska assented, and appeared relieved by the proposition, though her gloom was not lightened by Everill's gaiety. Mrs. Fletcher did not, of course, acquiesce to this arrangement, but she deemed it prudent to communicate her apprehensions to her trusted Digby. After a short consultation, it was agreed that Digby should remain on guard duty during the night, and that the two other men servants should have their muskets in order and be ready at a moment's warning. Such precautions were not infrequent and caused no unusual excitement in the household. Mrs. Fletcher had it, as she expressed herself, borne in upon her mind, after the evening exercise, to make some remarks upon the uncertainty of life. She then dismissed the family to their several apartments and herself retired to indite the epistle given above. Everill observed Magawiska closely through the evening, and he was convinced from the abstraction of her manner and from the efforts she made, which were now apparent to him, to maintain a calm demeanor, that there was more ground for his mother's apprehensions than he at first supposed. He determined to be companion of Digby's watch, and standing high in the good fellow's confidence, he made a private arrangement with him, which he easily effected without his mother's knowledge, for his youthful zeal did not render him regardless of the impropriety of heightening her fears. End of chapter 3.